It was many and many a year ago, in a kingdom by the sea, that a maiden there lived whom you may know by the name of Annabel Lee. And this maiden she lived with no other thought than to love and be loved by me. I was a child, and she was a child, in this kingdom by the sea. But we loved with a love that was more than a love, I and my Annabel Lee. With a love that the winged seraphs of heaven laughed loud at her and me. And this was the reason that long ago in this kingdom by the sea, a wind blew out of a cloud, chilling my beautiful Annabel Lee, so that her high-born kinsmen came and bore her away from me, to shut her up in a sepulchre in this kingdom by the sea. The angels, not half so happy in heaven, went laughing at her and me. Yes, that was the reason, as all men know in this kingdom by the sea, that the wind came out of the cloud by night, chilling and killing my Annabel Lee. But our love, it was stronger by far than the love of those who were older than we, of many far wiser than we. And neither the laughter in heaven above, nor the demons down under the sea, can ever dissever my soul from the soul of the beautiful Annabel Lee. For the moon never beams without bringing me dreams of the beautiful Annabel Lee, and the stars never rise, but I feel the bright eyes of the beautiful Annabel Lee. And so, all the night tide, I lie down by the side of my darling, my wife and my bride, in her sepulchre there by the sea, in her tomb by the sounding sea. Hello, listeners. This is Professor Jonas Armitage, and you're listening to Stories from Dark Places. Tonight's show, the story is The King in Yellow by Robert Chambers. The poem is Annabel Lee by Edgar Allan Poe. An interesting concept. A writer most prolifically known for his terrifying scripts, writing poems of love about the one that got away, even in a cosmic sense. We'll get to our story in just a moment, but first, I've stumbled upon something interesting I'd like to share with you. Anthropodermic bibliopagy, the process of binding books in human skin, whether it's the esoteric and heretofore unproven existence of the Necronomicon bound in human flesh, to more recent objects such as a copy of Mr. Poe's book, The Golden Bug, bound in flesh and sold at auction to a collector. Sometimes it's just the cover. Sometimes it's merely the spine. Sometimes the pages themselves. It's an interesting process, one that normally is done with the flesh of criminals, or in the terms of a particular saucy erotic novel written in France back in 1864. It was bound with the skin donated by the woman who the book, who had been the inspiration for the story. She had had a rather passionate, wild fling with the author, and as a woman of advanced age, as she was dying, she made request of him that he would bind the book with her flesh, that her body would continue to contain his love, even as the passage of time went on. Slightly morbid, slightly interesting, I think. Also worth noting that books bound in human skin tend to survive the passage of time much better than their terrestrial volumes, the more mundane constructs, as to whether that's simply because of the quality of leather or if there is some sort of magical concept to it. I can't say either way. I leave that up to you, but if perchance there were a copy of the Malleus Maleficarum bound in the skin of a witch from the Salem trials, would someone out there be interested in purchasing it? We have bills to pay here at the studio, and I'm just asking for a friend, I swear. Anyway, she'll get to our story this evening after this word from our sponsors.
Are you itching for a good story? Laughter among friends? Maybe a mystery? Fire Breathing Kittens is a standalone Dungeons & Dragons podcast. Each episode is a separate 3-hour long story, like a movie for your ears. You can listen to these adventures in any order. Join us on an actual play D&D quest as we solve mysteries, attempt comedic banter, and enjoy friendship. Fire Breathing Kittens Podcast. Fantasy, action, mystery, and friendship.
Some work that I was doing about this time on the decorations for Genevieve's boudoir kept me constantly at the quaint little hotel in the Rue Saint-Cécile. Boris and I in those days labored hard, but as we pleased, which was fitfully, and we all three, with Jack Scott, idled a great deal together. One quiet afternoon, I'd been wandering alone over the house, examining curios, prying into odd corners, bringing out sweetmeats and cigars from strange hiding places, and at last I stopped in the bathing room. Boris, all over clay, stood there washing his hands. The room was built of rose-colored marble, excepting the floor, which was tessellated in rose and gray. In the center was a square pool sunken below the surface of the floor. Steps led down into it. Sculptured pillars supported a frescoed ceiling. A delicious marble cupid appeared to have just alighted on its pedestal at the upper end of the room. The whole interior was Boris's work and mine. Boris, in his working clothes of white canvas, scraped the traces of clay and red modeling wax from his handsome hands, and coquetted over his shoulder with the cupid. "I see you," he insisted. "Don't try to look the other way and pretend not to see me. You know who made you, little humbug." It was always my role to interpret Cupid's sentiments in these conversations, and when my turn came I responded in such a manner, and Boris seized my arm and dragged me towards the pool, declaring he would duck me. Next instant he dropped my arm and turned pale. "Good God," he said, "I forgot the pool is full of the solution." I shivered a little, and dryly advised him to remember better where he had stored the precious liquid. "In heaven's name, why do you keep a small lake of that gruesome stuff here, of all places?" I said. "I want to experiment on something larger," he replied. "On me, for instance." "Oh, that came too close for jesting. But I do want to watch the action of that solution on a more highly organized living body. There's that big white rabbit," he said, following me into the studio. Jack Scott, wearing a paint-stained jacket, came wandering in, appropriated all the oriental sweetmeats he could lay his hands on, looted the cigarette case, and finally he and Boris disappeared together to visit the Luxembourg Gallery, where a new silver bronze by Rodin and a landscape of Monet's were claiming the exclusive attention of artistic friends. I went back to the studio and resumed my work. It was a Renaissance screen, which Boris wanted me to paint for Genevieve's boudoir, but the small boy who was unwillingly dawdling through a series of poses for it today refused all bribes to be good. He never rested an instant in the same position, and inside of 5 minutes I had as many different outlines of the little beggar. "Are you posing, or are you executing a song and dance, my friend?" I inquired. "Whichever monsieur pleases," he replied with an angelic smile. Of course I dismissed him for the day, and of course I paid him for the full time, that being the way we spoil our models. After the young imp had gone, I made a few perfunctory daubs at my work, but was so thoroughly out of humor, it took me the rest of the afternoon to undo the damage I had done. So at last I scraped my palette, stuck the brushes in a bowl of black soap, and strolled into the smoking room. I really believe that, excepting Genevieve's apartments, no room in the house was so free from the perfume of tobacco as this one. It was a queer chaos of odds and ends, hung with threadbare tapestry. A sweet-toned old spinet of good repair stood by the window. There were stands of weapons, some old and dull, others bright and modern, festoons of Indian and Turkish armor over the mantel, 2 or 3 good pictures, and a pipe rack. It was here that we used to come for new sensations in smoking. I wonder if any type of pipe ever existed which was not represented in that rack. When we had selected one, we immediately carried it somewhere else and smoked it, for the place was on the whole more gloomy and less inviting than any in the house. But this afternoon, the twilight was very soothing, the rugs and skins on the floor looked brown and soft and drowsy. The big couch was piled with cushions. I found my pipe and curled up there for an unaccustomed smoke in the smoking room. I had chosen one with a long, flexible stem, and lighting it fell to dreaming. After a while it went out, but I did not stir. I dreamed on, and presently fell asleep. I awoke to the saddest music I had ever heard. The room was quite dark. I had no idea what time it was. A ray of moonlight silvered one edge of the old spinet, and the polished wood seemed to exhale the sound as perfume floats above a box of sandalwood. Someone rose in the darkness and came away weeping quietly, and I was fool enough to cry out, "Genevieve?" She dropped at my voice, and I had time to curse myself while I made a light and tried to raise her from the floor. She shrank away with a murmur of pain. It was very quiet, and she asked for Boris. I carried her to the divan, and I went to look for him, but he was not in the house, and the servants were gone to bed. Perplexed and anxious, I hurried back to Genevieve. She lay where I had left her, looking very white. "I can't find Boris or any of the servants," I said.
"I know," she answered faintly. "Boris has gone to Ept with Mr. Scott. I did not remember when I sent you for him just now."
"But he can't get back in the case before tomorrow afternoon. Are you hurt? Did I frighten you into falling? What an awful fool I am. I was only half awake."
"Boris thought you had gone home before dinner. Do please excuse us for letting you stay here all the time."
"I have had a long nap," I laughed, so sound that I did not know whether I was still asleep or not when I found myself staring at a figure that was moving toward me and called out your name. "Have you been trying the old spinet? You must have been playing very softly."
I could tell a thousand more lies worse than that one to see the look of relief that came to her face. She smiled adorably and said in her natural voice, "Alec, I tripped on the wolf's head. I think my ankle is sprained. Please call Marie and go home." I did as she bade me, and I left her there when the maid came in.
This is really shaping up to be an interesting story. What's the deal with her? Is she mentally ill? Is she perhaps of the plague? I believe that was an event at the time. What is this switch between her behaviors with different people? I have my theories, but I don't want to spoil it for anyone. I hope you're enjoying this as much as I am. I can't wait to see where it ends when we reach the finale in the weeks to come. Feel free to send us email or to leave a message on Anchor regarding your feelings of the show. We would love to hear from you. Put it on the air if you would be consenting. Again, this show exists only because of the kindness and the diligence and the ever-appreciated presence of our audience. Thank you for being here to share this journey with us. But that's all the time we have tonight. Good night, listeners. And please remember, no matter what you hear, as you see, what happens, what sounds accompany you through the shadows of the house, remember this, there's nothing to be afraid of. After all, some of the best things only happen in the dark.
Stories from Dark Places was recorded before an imaginary studio audience. All stories performed on this podcast have express written consent from the original author. Jonas Armitage, his studio manager, and the entire staff of WZHB Radio Innsmouth are fictitious characters, and it's probably for the best that you continue to believe that.
Hello, listeners. Looking for more tales to entertain with esoteric delight and supernatural suspense? I would encourage you to check out Peculiar Stories. Join Indiana Beckett as she takes you on a walk around her particular side of the neighborhood in all things strange and unusual. You may find her on Anchor Podcasts or anywhere that your podcast can be found.